Reg is one of those people who are a gift to any drinks party because he doesn't mind talking to anyone and he can talk. And he was waxing lyrical to me about the joys of learning golf in retirement. He said how wonderful the golf club was that he joined. He said the only thing was, he said, when you're there, you have to do golf speak and I only do construction site speak. He sort of explained a little bit what he meant and, you know, how the golf club, he said, it's polite. Well, it's over-polite. He said, you get there and you have to shake hands with everyone. And when you're playing, you sort of say, your ball is further away, you go first. And at the end, you shake hands with everyone again. But you always have to do golf speak. And they kept pulling me to one side and saying, you can't do construction site speak here. And I explained to them, look, where I came from, because they were all lawyers and medics and accountants. There wasn't a tradesman amongst them. But where I came from, I mean, you know, on the construction sites, if you weren't effing and blinding all the time, they'd wonder where you were from and think you were a toff and so on. And he said, well, anyway, I've learned how to do golf speak now. If my conversation with him was anything to go by, that was only relatively speaking that he'd learned. But he told me he got the prize for the most improved golfer this year, and he thought it was really about his language. And he actually showed that it was all absolutely genuine, because about 20 minutes into the conversation, he finally sort of asked me a question. He said, what do you do? And I said, I'm a clergyman. And, you know, you talk to a number of professionals, you'll just see a flicker behind the eyes when you say that, as they rerun the last 20 minutes to think, what have I said? Reg did not blink. Oh, he said, I don't believe in anything at all. I mean, what do you think of Catholics who have abused children for centuries? Well, I swallowed, and before I could say anything, he came up. And people are cutting off heads and crucifying them all in the name of God. Well, you can't afford to sort of roll over and lie down for too long with Regis around. So I had a little go back, and I said, yeah, you're right. At the beginning of this century, it does seem to be in the name of religion that all kinds of atrocities are happening. In the last century, I said, it was the atheist dictators who slaughtered millions. There's not a lot of moral high ground for anyone to stand on there. Well, he kind of rolled on, and he began to talk, move from extremists to immigration, and he kind of went on about how he really didn't want immigration around him, and then he went back to the extremists and the Islamists, and I said after a bit, I said, look, there is another way. I said, I don't know any more about what's happening in Iraq and Syria than what I read in the media, but I do know a bit more about Nigeria. And they've got the same violence that's happened there, and I said, I've been out there this summer. Been with a friend of mine, Ben Kwashi, who's now the Archbishop of Jos. I said, you know, there's been all kinds of thousands have been killed in recent years. He's had his home burnt down, his family attacked, his life threatened at gun and knife point. I said, he and his wife Gloria, they've picked up orphans from all kinds of backgrounds, Muslims as much as Christians, and they've just brought them into their family. I was at family prayers there. I said, and I counted, I got to 43. Oh, said Ridge, I couldn't do that. I said, that's the difference, isn't it? You want to get rid of them. Ben wants to win them. And what a difference in attitudes. Now, if only he'd asked, you know, I can't do that, what makes him able to? I could have told him what makes Ben tick. It's what we want to have as our heartbeat here. I mean, if this is the beginning of term, beginning of year, put your head round the door, what is this church, what have I come to, what's it all about evening? Well, let me tell you. What makes us tick here at All Souls is the Jesus you can read about in verses 5 to 11. The Messiah, the rescuer king who lived out the idea that the way to up is down. The Jesus who had it all. And gave it up to become, well, in the words of verse 7, nothing. A servant. A man, verse 8. Humbled to death, even death on a cross. The Jesus for whom that wasn't the end of the story, and indeed whose story every one of us is caught up in one way or another. Because God thinks so much of this Jesus that he places Jesus, verse 9, above every name. Insists that every knee should bow, verse 10, every tongue acknowledge, verse 11, that Jesus Christ is Lord. So come to All Souls, and if you don't hear about this Jesus, please check if the heart is still beating. Of course, it's a familiar history to many of us, but it's not intended to stay as history. How do you bring history alive? Now, you can't rerun it. But in this case, you can show the same attitudes and the same mindset. You can see something of Jesus in the lives of his followers. And that's what Paul's looking for in this young Christian community. Oh, living within the lifetime of those who'd witnessed the history, but too far away in Philippi to have actually been part of it themselves. And that's what his words urge on us as a church now. See, bringing Jesus alive in us. He's told the salvation history in verses 5 to 11, and then he applies it. He engages with their lives, with our lives in verse 12, and you see what he says towards the end of that verse. He says, work out your salvation. Not work for your salvation, as if you've got to earn it. No, work out your salvation. You've got it. Now live the consequences. Live the transformation. Bring Jesus alive in you. Oh, do it with fear and trembling, you notice he goes on. And not with cringing terror, but with great care. With a sense of the awesome privilege of handling such a responsibility. All of that down to you and me? No, look how verse 13 goes. For it is God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose. We are people, this is a community in which God is at work. In which new desires I wouldn't naturally aspire to shape my will. Desires to do the good, the right, the just, the godly thing. I mean, if you never experienced that in your life, you kind of wonder, oh, where did that come from? It was so right that it wasn't normal. That's the wonder of it and the pain of it. I read this line this week. It really struck me. Someone wrote, gospel-driven humility is ready to give away power, possessions, privileges, and preferences. Now, you see that happening in a group of people, and it is strikingly different, isn't it? Of course, if and when we give away power and preferences, we need to guard heart attitudes too. I mean, it's no wonder he puts in the warning of verse 40. Do everything without grumbling or arguing. You know, we've all heard the good deed done and accompanied with the sort of, well, I've done my bit, grumble. Or, what more do you want? Paul stretched this young community all the way, doesn't he? Verse 15 speaks about blameless and pure and without fault. And at the same time, he doesn't pull his punches about the setting in which they and we are to live it out. He talks about it being in a warped and crooked generation. Now, that's not just a barbed comment aimed at an increasingly secular or jihadist culture. The phrase is borrowed from the Old Testament book of Deuteronomy, where it was used of the people of God, those who knew him as Father and Creator. It was the kind of phrase Jesus used of the religious people of his day, a crooked generation. It's down here as if it might be people's experience within church walls, as well as without them. But he longs for it not to be the experience here. He calls us to stand out, to stand distinctive, to bring Jesus' attitudes and mindsets alive in us. And then he says, verse 15, you will shine among them like stars in the sky. Shine like stars. That's the call. That's the dream. That's the vision. It's not really a London picture, is it? It's hard to see stars in the sky in London. You just see light pollution. But you can understand the picture, can't you? Each one of us like stars. I mean, hundreds of us just with tonight's congregation. Stars appearing here, there, everywhere, all around London. As, verse 16, you hold firmly to the word of life. Or some translations have, as you hold out the word of life, the word of this Jesus. It could be either. It needs to be both. You can't hold firmly to this word without holding it out for others. And you can only hold it out to others in our culture and society if you hold firmly to it. So what does all of that actually look like in practice? What would it mean if you stumbled into a community that was all part of shining like stars? Well, not time to flesh it all out, but here are three things. Here are three things that will be a mark of that kind of a community. Three things I love to feel were part of the All Souls family. I mean, here's the first, shining like stars, that you love. Now, of course, nothing could be more predictable than to include the love word. I mean, who wouldn't? And it's been reduced, hasn't it, to something bland and cozy and warm fuzzies, but not here. Look again at verses 5 to 11, will you? And you'll see that what motivates Jesus is actually obedience to the Father. Verse 8 is so striking, isn't it? It becoming obedient to death. But actually, what he's speaking of is of uniting his will to the Father's, the God who so loved the world, the nations, enemies as well as allies. Jesus willingly shares that love for enemies. Some of us struggle to move down the street to those who aren't like us. Will Pooley is the British nurse who went to help Ebola victims in Sierra Leone, volunteered to help look after them, caught the disease himself, and was flown back to this country, given special treatment just down the road at the Royal Free Hospital. He's recovered now. There were some extraordinary malicious comments that went around when he was flown back and all that happened. All that expense, someone complained. Charity begins at home. Work out your salvation, Paul encourages. And there wouldn't have been a salvation if God thought charity began at home. It's precisely because Jesus left home that we can be saved. It's only when that kind of love is worked into us and then worked out through us that we'll shine like stars as you hold out the word of life. And it's a love that includes enemies. It's a love that God Jesus executed. He humbled himself even to death on a cross. I've seen that love worked out, and it's very impressive when you see it. Again, when I was in Jos in Nigeria in the summer, I was driven around some of the hot spots where there have been troubles and all kinds of killings and massacres in the past. And a minister of one of the local churches did it, and he was often able to point out areas where some of his congregation were involved. He showed me one street, he said, where one of his church family members, born-again Christian, lived. And in one of the times of troubles, a Muslim lad got himself in the area in the wrong place. A gang of youths saw him, chased him. He raced down the street to keep ahead of them and just dashed at random into a house. And it turned out to be the house of this Christian man and his family. The mob came to the door, hammered on the door, and when the Christian came there, demanded that he bring the Muslim out for them to deal with. He refused. They insisted he had to. He said, no, where I come from, if someone comes into your house, you're obliged to give them hospitality and look after them. I'm not handing him over. Eventually, they left. He fed him, gave him a bed for the night. Family were asleep. He went off to do a late night shift. And when he came back in the early morning, he found the front door of his house was open. When he went in, he discovered the Muslim man had got up in the night, taken a knife from the kitchen drawer, and slaughtered his entire family. When the minister who was telling me this story says to his congregation, says to this man, and I know he does, love your enemies, it is saying something so radically different from anything that crosses my mind when someone says to me, love your enemies, isn't it? Love your enemies. I don't have any enemies like that. I'm short on enemies. And then I'm short on a love that travels down the street, that's willing to be weak and vulnerable with those I think will be opposed, that's prepared to look a fool and get it wrong culturally with those from other backgrounds. See, I talked to an evangelist out there who's planted 5 churches in an area. They're largely made up of converted drug addicts and alcoholics. I said, what was the secret? He said, we just loved them. I mean, to be honest, there was nothing more than that. We just loved them. I said, well, weren't there other churches around? He said, yes, there were several other churches around. I said, what about them? What did they feel about you coming in? Oh, they didn't mind. They didn't really want anything to do with these people. We just loved them. And they shone like stars. Yeah. Love, sure. But if it's Jesus' love that's being worked out in my life, you are entitled to ask, what does my love cost? The religious world is too full of a love that's restricted to their own. You know, that waits for others to make the costly move towards them, that has never made itself weak and vulnerable. And Jesus' love will take me into far edgier situations. Love, yeah. Well, here's a second one, serve. I mean, this comes alongside love. It can be just as striking, because in a world full of take, whether your stereotype is sort of scrounger from Benefit Street or fat cat from the city, in a world where consumerism and entitlement are far more infectious than any of those extremes suggest, where take what I want, I have a right to what I can enjoy, shape the excesses of a fresher's week and the selfishnesses of relationships. In that kind of a world, a group that lives verse 3, you know, values others above yourselves, not looking to your own interests, but each of you to the interests of others. I mean, that group will shine like stars in a dark and corrupt world, in a warped and crooked generation. It's very striking when you see people serving one another. And you notice it, you go into a family, and the kids automatically help clear away cheerfully. You notice it, don't you? And we'll have to hold firmly to the word of life if we're going to pull that off. Hold firmly to the word of this Jesus so that his mindset becomes our mindset. I mean, the religious world can be a backbiting one like any other. A place where people stand on their dignity and hold to their position and, you know, we'll do that rather than get their hands dirty. We'll have to hold very firmly to the word of the Jesus who did not consider his position something to be used to his own advantage. Rather, he made himself a nobody. You up for that? Christians aren't always easy to get on with. Never mind to serve. You know, the mindset of a Jesus who valued people, even irritating people, so highly he thought they were worth dying for, that mindset becomes essential. On top of that, all the usual pressures make it hard to serve others. We're so busy, so stretched. A great thing about the New Testament is that it really doesn't sort of hide all those kind of problems. The early Christian church ran into that problem within six chapters in the book of Acts. I mean, they were all so overstretched and busy that their kind of little soup kitchen was beginning to mess up, and it was meant to feed and look after the widows. And instead, what happened is that some were getting food and others weren't, and it began to look racist. Not, I think, because people were deliberately like that, but what happens when you're overstretched? Well, you look after the ones you know, and, you know, it kind of goes that way. And so one group were getting and others weren't, and they had to solve the whole problem and sort it out. And as soon as they had, Luke writes in the next verse and he says, and the word of the Lord grew. Not, I think, because he imagines that by giving someone soup, the word of the Lord grows, but because the justice with which we treat one another, the care we show to one another matters. And people will look in from the outside and check how that happens. It makes the word of life plausible. Don't feel you're without opportunity to serve one another here. I mean, you know, the opportunities are endless, you know, even on a Sunday, from pouring tea to teaching the youth, supporting those learning English to, well, that welcome table, that welcome zone at the back under the gallery to my left, they've got lists of ways. And if you want to help serve, please go there. They'd love to see you. And service is going to go beyond these four walls, isn't it, if we're going to shine like stars. There are some church-organized ways of serving our community. I'll mention them in a moment. But hundreds of individual stars going out tonight into a dark city, going out for this week ahead into homes and neighborhoods and offices and local schools and shining. I've never forgotten a student telling me about coming up to halls of residence. He found he was sharing a kind of bedsit. There were sort of two little bedrooms off one sitting room, and he got there later than the other guy. So by the time he arrived, the other guy was settled in, the other guy had chosen everything. He said, it was only in the days and weeks that followed that I realized the other guy chose the worst bed, the worst chair, the worst table. I'd got the best of them all. He's never forgotten. Love, serve, give. See, how do you take a history like Jesus and work it out in your life today? It's the greatest act of self-giving there's been, and you can't stand alongside Jesus and start mouthing, charity begins at home. Stumble across a community of Jesus people and you'd expect generosity at every level. In a world where make money drowns out give it, where protect your money shouts far louder than give it away, in a religious world where the stats show that the more affluent give less generously than the poorest. Well, here's a way to shine like stars. Give. You know, there's a generosity we're called to, and you'd expect to see in our budgets. Last Sunday, we heard about our World Mission Fund. We're committed to giving £350,000 a year to support some 50 mission partners, Carphoon's the latest, 50 partner projects right around the world. Holding out the word of life to abused women in India, disadvantaged poor in Mexico, those suffering in the conflict in South Sudan, by church planting, Bible translating, preacher training. I mean, it's wonderful to be caught up as partners in a global gospel, and it's costly. This last push at the end of the year, we're aiming for £100,000. We raised a third on the first day. It's the last two-thirds that's tricky now. And then on Monday, the PCC met to decide our budget. They planned the income and expenditure for this academic year. And they bravely aimed to raise nearly an extra 10% income this year. Committed us as a church to it, not to line our pockets, but to support and grow ministries. We want to invest where God seems to be at work. So we need to go on investing and growing our investment in our student ministries, where he's been at work in the last couple of years, noticeably so. We want to do it with our Serve the City ministries, ways in which we serve the community around us, the homeless, the trafficked people in the sex trade, the loneliness of those caring for young babies, almost unbelievable loneliness we discovered, in the affluent circles of the West End. We need to invest more in our buildings as well, we discovered, but when you've got a building on such a location, now how else do you get a platform for the gospel right at the heart of the West End, and you want to keep it so that it can communicate as well as possible and hold out the word of life? What a priceless asset. Well, the financial challenges are always large. Give or make. Sow or keep. What we do with our money reflects who we are as individuals and who we are as a community. Now, let me say this, and if you're new to All Souls, you can listen to this one with as clear a conscience as you like. What evidence there is, and it's all erratic, points to this being a particular challenge for the evening congregation. And people have commented to me before on the speed with which the baskets seem able to get from one end of the church to the other during the offering hymn and land up as light as they were when they started. And I mention, you know, people give by standing orders and others come in the morning and have given already, and they look at me as unconvinced that it's the whole story as I suspect I am. I've been here before, though. 25 years ago, I was working at St. Helen's Bishopsgate, a church in the city. The evening congregation was made up almost entirely of students and people in their 20s, maybe just in their 30s. You know, they got their first job and so on, and very little money came from them. They were largely the ones that just received the ministry. The money came from the businessmen that flocked in for the Tuesday lunchtime service, and it came from the families who were there on the Sunday morning. And then one Sunday lunchtime, I just got home. We were just sitting down to family lunch, and the phone rang. And it was the Foreign Office. And one of our mission partners had been shot in the head in Africa, and he needed to be medevaced home straight away. And his mission agency had no insurance out on him. And could I guarantee, I can't remember the exact figure, it was north of £30,000, this is 25 years ago, so they would fly him out. They weren't going to fly him out until we gave them the money. Well, you kind of don't really say, we'll try and raise it in the next week or two or anything. So you say, yes, I go to the congregation that night and I say, look, this is what's just hit us. We've got to find over £30,000 to get this guy home. Within 24 hours, we had all the money. The big givers never got a chance. Didn't have to ask. I remember one of our most generous donors coming in, getting his checkbook out, and the look of disappointment on his face when I said, no, we've got it all. That was the night. That was the night that unlocked the door to giving for that congregation. Generosity started to flow. One of the student leaders in All Souls in 2014 said, I'd give if I thought there was a need. There is. So nice when there's a short answer. So, if you want to start on the challenge tonight, well, at the welcome zone, at the bottom of the stairs at the information desk, there'll be someone who can take card donations, who's got all the standing orders. That saves you next week when you forgot to bring anything. For both the World Mission Fund, the General Fund, head there, sort it out, let's go meet the challenge. This year as a congregation, let's meet the challenge. Let's shine like stars as we give, as we hold out the word of life to our city, to a lost and darkened world. Love, serve, give. When we say welcome to All Souls, we want to be saying welcome to the Jesus who gave himself for us. Welcome to a family who knows that experience, is working it out together for others. Love, serve, give. And in a world that can seem wonderfully exciting, but at the same time is very dark and warped and crooked, welcome to beacons of light. To those who not just when we come together, but when we scatter across London during the week, will shine like stars. It's a thrilling thought if you look around the room. See how many stars. So before we sing our final hymn, why don't we just stop and start thinking and praying, what does God need to do in, work in you and me? If we're going to shine like stars, if we're going to love and serve and give like this. Let's be still as we see the stars come up and pray that God would work in us, and then we'll sing together.